Today's program is brought to you by Amber App, a revolutionary iPad point-of-sale system that can be used at a restaurant, bar, coffee shop, or food truck. For more information, visit amberapp.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, friends. This is Phil Colicchio, and you are listening to The Business of the Business, the show here on the Heritage Radio Network that explores the business side of the hospitality industry. And we talk about restaurants, and we talk about hotels, and we talk about travel, and we talk about the other businesses that involve and evolve from the hospitality industry. We air every Wednesday at 5 p.m. here at the Radio Network, the heritageradionetwork.org, with my friend Jack Inslee out there taking good care of us. And if it's okay with everybody else, I think I'd like to get down to business. When I was a boy, I told my dad that I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. And I remember his response vividly. It was very simple, but it was just the same, very thoughtful. He said to me, "That's good, son, because lawyers can do anything they want to do." Well, you know, my dad was right most of the time, and I think he was right all the time. I just didn't realize he was right all the time. And while his son has not done a whole lot in the professional world outside of the law, my guest today, Jasmine Moy, is a lawyer. But she is a lawyer with many passions. Jasmine is a terrific writer, a terrific storyteller. She's published in Esquire magazine. She's published in the Wall Street Journal, the Huffington Post. She's written about as far-flung subject matter as Valentine's Day dining. The consequences of being a four-star restaurant, and the occasional bed bug. How about that? Indeed. Jasmine, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled that you could come out here today, and I'm always thrilled to talk to a lawyer who has the ability to do what you do, which is to write and communicate effectively. I really would love to get a little bit of background about how you got to law school. And I know we talked a little bit before the show that writing was not your initial passion.
No, it wasn't. Although I was an English major, so I was a very good reader. Mm-hmm. And I've always said that very good readers have the potential to be extremely good writers. But yeah, I was an arts management major in college, and then I graduated from college. And when I grew up, we just never had money. And I thought, oh gosh, do I really want to go into the arts, another place where nobody makes any money? And so that was probably maybe not the best reason to go to law school, but a little bit I thought lawyers can make a good living. So that was a little bit, and I thought if I got into a good law school and if I did well on my tests, that would be a sign and I should go.
Well, as a fellow English major who got seduced a little bit in college by writing and thought that I could go and actually had this conversation with a professor that said, no, I want to go to law school and I'll write as well. And he said to me, no, you won't. And it turned out that he was accurate, that I didn't get a chance to exercise that interest that I had. But you did. And you went to Ithaca College, and you obviously did well enough to go to a terrific law school, Fordham, here in New York. Mm-hmm. Was it always in your mind to come to New York and live this kind of life, the New York City life?
No, you know, I had never really even been to New York City before I moved here. So I was taking a certain leap of faith in the city that I'd heard so many good things about. And so I guess I was very fortunate to have since fallen very desperately and deeply in love with New York City once I got here.
You're not the only one I've heard tell that story. Well, terrific. But again, you came here to be a lawyer. You got through Fordham Law School. What was the job market like for you when you got out of law school?
The market was, I would say, certainly better than it is right now, but that's saying almost nothing. The market was not fantastic.
Right.
And so, you know, I ended up taking a bunch of contract work.
Right.
Which, one, paid more money than I had ever seen, really, which was really convenient for a place like New York, where
sure
you
is.
Can spend money
right.
really more easily than anywhere else that I've ever been.
Ever been to London?
Well, yes. Well, I was going to say, and also the best food of anywhere.
Okay.
So I think it's the triad of having the money and the restaurants existing, and then spending all of that money in those restaurants.
Well, you know, a lot of your writing, and over the past few days, I've really enjoyed digging through your articles.
Thanks.
A lot of your writing, I see, does have some lawyerly instinct to it. I'll say analytical, unafraid to take a subject matter and actually take it apart as you write. Where did this writing start? Where did the idea that you were going to write and actually write as a professional, when did that start? Before law school? After law school?
It was after law school. I don't think anybody who's in law school, or even after law school, if they paid for it themselves, paying for law school, really thinks, oh, I should be a writer. That sounds like a great idea. Because it is extremely difficult to make money as a writer. But as far as the analytical writing goes, I am going to 100% thank my law school career for that.
Yeah.
You know, you do, it's been a little maybe while for you versus for me, but you do a lot of writing in law school, and if you're not very analytical about it, if you're not convincing about it, you've wasted everybody's time. So that transfers, I think, over to the food writing I do, or to any other writing, as I say, you know, especially if I have an opinion about something, you really want to make sure that you are making sure that by the time they're done with the piece, that your opinion is the only one that they have by the time that they're done.
You know,
you've got to knock away everybody else's on the way there.
I'm following you completely. I guess the thing that interests me most, this is a hospitality show. It's about the mm-hmm. hospitality business. You chose to exercise that that writing demon in the hospitality industry. Why that? Why not write the great Midwestern American novel, or the new kid in New York City kind of?
Restaurants are at my soul, I think. My very first job was when I was 15, and I was a hostess at a California pizza kitchen. And I graduated from being a hostess to being a food runner. And then I actually, when I was old enough, because I think you had to be 16 in order to serve alcohol. Mm-hmm. And they served wine at CPK. So then I started waiting tables, and once I was waiting tables, I kind of progressed into nicer restaurants, which really got me more into the wine culture, which really got me more into just food in general and knowing good food. So, I mean, for a very long time, I have just loved restaurants, thrived in restaurants, you know,
and
never really thought that I would live and die serving,
right.
Although I love it.
Well, I think Mr. Dillon, Mr. Dillon told us we all serve somebody, and we're going to continue to serve people, whether it's in our legal profession, or whether it's in the hospitality field. How did you pull the trigger on it? I mean, you're a busy lawyer. You know, you're home one night and you say, I have to write. Do I have to write a food blog? Do I have to be a restaurant critic? But how did you do it?
Well, the short answer is a friend of mine who I was blogging for a while. So I actually started blogging, but it was personal. It wasn't about food. It was just about New York and funny things happen to you in New York and like that, you know, homeless people yell funny things at you. And then
you're sitting at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
This is before Facebook, right. You know, this is before anybody was on Facebook. This is before Twitter existed. And so really blogs were an outlet for just, I need to get this out. This is a hilarious story. I need to tell somebody about it. But one day when I was feeling kind of particularly frustrated with my day job and the amount of time I was spending at my day job, a friend of mine sent me a link for a travel writing class at NYU with a man named David Farley. And if you read the New York Times or a Farm magazine, you'll see his byline all over the place. And so kind of on a whim, I signed up for this class. And I also took about a year off from my job. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I'm going to take this travel writing class, and then I'm going to travel, and then I'm going to pay for the travel by selling all of these pieces about writing, which is such a refreshing kind of optimistic thing to tell yourself.
It also sounds naive.
Certainly. Okay. Certainly.
But you actually learned how to make a business out of it, didn't you?
You know, this class, and I would highly recommend it. And he teaches it, I think, in the spring semester every year.
But he's
extremely generous about teaching you exactly what you need to do in order to get paid to do this work. He teaches you exactly what you need to give editors, what they're looking for, what a pitch should look like, how and when you should pitch.
And this work, when you say this work, you mean freelance.
Freelance writing.
Freelance writing about travel and hospitality and restaurants and the like, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, every travel piece is, if you pick it up, probably 50% about food. I mean, because so much of a place that you go is best examined by looking at what people eat and the way that they eat and the way that they share meals together. So the best way to learn about a place is really through eating, I think.
Well, I actually...
Or drinking and meeting locals and things like that.
In reading one of your articles, which I thought, again, was insightful, you posed a criticism to some folks who go to far off places to open cafes that serve only tourists, and they don't become part of the local culture, right? Part of the indigenous world that they move to, and you pointed out what a contradiction that really was to say I want to escape my life yet and go thousands of miles away, but recreate it the same life I had.
Not to knock this too much because it's cool and everybody probably wishes they could do this, but especially like the Brits and the Aussies who like will take a gap year and just do nothing but travel. They all travel in clumps and stay in the same neighborhood in every city they go into and drink at like a Mexican place with supersized margaritas, no matter where they are in the world, whether somewhere where margaritas are a natural occurring beverage or not. My problem was a little bit these people who are traveling and not really learning about their culture and not really meeting their people and not really doing the things that I feel like are the point of travel that are so enriching. They're missing the point
and
of travel.
Not everyone is as fearless as Jasmine Moy.
this may be true.
Jasmine is my guest today on The Business of the Business. And Jasmine is an attorney and a very good attorney. She's also a terrific food and hospitality writer. What are some of your favorite topics to cover when you are writing?
You mean outside of food? Food's my favorite.
Well, let's talk about when we come back. We're going to take a break in a little bit, and when we come back, I actually found one of your articles really interesting about the knots that fourth star can tie can tie a restaurateur up into, but. When you got into this, were you saying I want to be a food critic, or I just want to write about the scene?
No, you know, it was more a matter of when you want to be writing about something, you need to have access to people who want to talk to you about that thing. And because I was such a diligent eater outer in New York, I had a lot of connections in the restaurant industry. I knew a lot of owners and bartenders and people who would love to talk to me about whatever cocktail they're making or how their restaurant is running. And and so really, because I was always eating out and because I was familiar with people in that industry, that was a natural place for me to start, because those were the best people to start talking to start writing.
Well, the word fearless comes up again. It sounds like Jasmine Moy is fearless about her travel, is fearless about her career, and fearless about the neighborhoods in New York. Jasmine, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want you to talk about how you get paid by doing what you do. It is about the business. And it's all about the business. You're listening to Phil Colicchio on The Business of the Business, heritageradionetwork.org.
As always, you're listening to Movement and Location by the Punch Brothers on heritageradionetwork.org.
We'd like to send a special thank you to our latest business member, Amber Point of Sale. At Amber Point of Sale, their mission is to help food service business owners take control of their restaurants, bars, or cafes. Amber is an easy-to-use point-of-sale system that allows you to take orders tableside, process credit cards, run reports, and manage inventory all through Apple's iPad and without spending tens of thousands of dollars on a system too complicated to use. To learn more, head to amberapp.com. That's AmburApp.com. Or give them a call at 888-770-2205 to discuss what Amber can do for you.
To learn more about becoming a business member, email us, info@heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, we're back here on The Business of the Business here at theheritageradionetwork.org. I forgot to mention earlier that if you missed this broadcast, and I don't know too many people who miss it, but if you do, it's available on the archive here at heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes. I have not yet listened to the show as a podcast on iTunes, but I hope to do that before my my career here is over. Jasmine, we started talking about your foray into writing and writing as a profession, getting paid for it. The idea that you could write about something that you found to be so much fun and so exhilarating, which was the food culture in New York. How do you get paid for it? How does it work?
You know, you have to do a couple of things. You have to first develop something of a tough shell because you are going to spend a lot of time. You have to have an idea, have ideas. You know, if you're at a restaurant and somebody's serving a vegetable that you've never even heard of, you know, Google that vegetable. Maybe that's the next trend. It's, you know, this weird lettuce, zucchini hybrid, something, something. But, you know, it starts with an idea. And then you have to pitch that idea, which is a kind of a letter saying, "Hey, this is a great story."
Who do you pitch it to, and how do you, and like, what's the universe of the pitch?
You know, you pitch it to whatever your relevant editor, which, you know, if you take David Farley's class, he's got a lot of names, and he's happy to share them. But otherwise, you Google, you find the masthead, you find the name, you can, you know, trick the email extensions, you know, anybody at the New York Times is, you know, I don't know this
Someone
for sure.
But
exactly. First letter of the first name, last name at nytimes.com. So, you know, there's a certain amount of cold calling, but also the minute you want to start making money writing, you have to start networking like crazy. Go to panel discussions, meet people, introduce yourselves to the people who are giving these talks about social media, or, you know, there's always a travel writing symposium at like the Javits Center. Go there, meet these people, meet writers. They're always happy to share information with
you. How did you sell your first piece? I'm really curious.
I had a friend who was doing graphics at the Wall Street Journal, and he said, "Oh, I know the food editor there. Let me connect you via email." But that was through a completely separate friend who was doing something completely separate. But you never know unless you just start asking around. Hey, does anybody know somebody at New York Magazine? Does anybody know somebody at the New York Times? And you never know how you can get connected. But getting connected, Right. Is you know, but have a good idea. Getting, you know, digging around, sleuthing around to finding the right person is the second step. And then there's, unfortunately, kind of a lot of waiting. You know, you send that out into the ether and right. you hope that they love it. You give it a few weeks, you follow back up again. And, right. you know, for every person who does this full time, they're going to get rejected, maybe a lot, right. before they start to get accepted. So you really have to just be diligent. You have to keep at it.
So it sounds a lot like acting. It sounds
certainly,
a lot,
you know, certainly it, like auditioning, and
right. But it also to me sounds like again, it requires a discipline that I find is a common thread in the hospitality industry. That the idea is to make it all look easy. Yeah, it really is. The idea is to make it all look easy. Mm-hmm. But to make it look easy, it takes hours and hours and hours of practice, and, mm-hmm. and as you said, probably a few getting over the bumps in the road. Mm-hmm. Your first pitch, was it to the Wall Street Journal?
No, you know what, actually, I also had a friend who was working at Esquire, so I think my first pitch was to them, and there was a restaurant that I was going to all the time.
Tell me about it.
I was going to Joseph Leonard all the time, mm-hmm. Spending an awful lot of money there, but the man who owns that restaurant, his name is Gabriel Stallman.
Sure.
And I said, "Hey, Gabe, you know, would you if I could sell a piece to somebody about you, would you sit down and do an interview?" And you know, he's, I don't want to say he's press shy, but he's a little quiet.
I know, Gabe.
And yeah. And he said, "You know, for you, sure, I will sit down." And so then I go to Esquire. Hey, I have access to Gabe Stallman, who's already agreed to do an interview with me. And then of course they say, "Oh, we would love to have an interview." So you know, you have to. Yeah, it's something you triangulate a little bit. I don't mean for it to sound that conniving, but yeah, no. I mean, you really do have to find out where all of your connections are, and you have to really work all of them, because this can be a very, I don't want to say cutthroat, but it's difficult. Lots of people want to be writers, so you've got to find an in.
I am not struggling at all finding why the lawyer in you and the writer in you coexist, because it sounds like you spend a lot of time advocating,
mm-hmm.
and I note that in your writing as well. I thought one of your pieces that I'd really like to talk about was a piece that you wrote about Del Posto,
mm-hmm.
and the fourth star, and mm-hmm. when and what that meant from a gut grinding point of view,
mm-hmm.
is really the reason I thought that the article was interesting. It wasn't a flowery piece about how wonderful things are once you get a fourth star. It's about the frankly, the pressure of keeping it up. I've always been of the opinion, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly, that chasing a fourth star in New York as a restaurant was economic suicide. That it costs so much to accomplish it, and so few people get to really enjoy it that. I always thought to myself, "Gosh, that's got to be a very difficult unicorn to lasso." How did you find it when you spoke? I mean, you spoke to the chef, you spoke to the general manager, you spoke to the owners after it happened.
Yeah, and you know, it's the funny thing about being a writer is that you always think that a story is going to be one way, and then it's really funny when it just veers and then ends up in a completely different. Place, but I really thought it was going to be more of like a front of house staffing issue. Like, oh my gosh, we've got all these extra private events, or even just supply and demand. I thought it was going to be a whole lot of, okay, well, we had to find all of these other suppliers for all of this extra food because we were doing X many more covers a night. So I didn't really, I thought it was just was going to be, we had to staff up and this is how we did it procedurally.
Right.
And then you sit them down and they're kind of like, we wanted it. We're glad we have it. It gives us so much security as a restaurant. You know, restaurants with four stars don't just close. They don't just close. You know, people will always keep showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was funny because it's just, you could, they were honest with me about how stressful that is and how it takes some of the fun out of it. And then once you're on that pedestal about how you can't fall from there. And so there's so much just pressure. And my favorite line from that piece was Jeff Katz, who's a manager there, said, you know, when people are maybe even slightly unsatisfied with something, the first thing out of their mouth is, this is not a 4-star restaurant.
Right.
So, you know, then people come in with expectations, which are so much higher and maybe even more difficult to meet. I didn't expect for that to happen.
No,
It makes sense once they told me, but that's not exactly where I thought that piece was going to go.
I found, again, in reading the article, I personally found it refreshing that the discussion went into a human being discussion,
mm-hmm.
saying the chef wasn't afraid to say, Mark Ladin wasn't afraid to say, no, it's not as much fun anymore. It's not as much fun anymore because you know, the pressure's really on. Now, mm-hmm. now maybe if we talked to him today, right, he'd say, well, I've learned how to manage that pressure. I've learned how to surf that wave, yeah. and now I'm having fun again. I can create new things.
Yeah.
But I was interested and I was intrigued, and I saw the same type of spirit in your writing when you wrote about some of the smaller restaurants who were seeking to get liquor licenses. I found that in New York City. And I can't wait for the article where you blow the cover off of the community boards that you told me you once sat on a community board in this town.
I did.
That must have been an experience. But before we get to that, I saw the lawyer's take, you know, and the writer's sensibility on how difficult it can be just to get over that small hump of getting a liquor license in a community where you don't live.
Yeah, that's you know, I think I wrote that piece, Eater.com, which mm-hmm. is obviously a very popular food blog. They do a lot of the updates about community board meetings and who is objecting and why, and certain community boards were starting to get reputations as being very evil or very difficult. And so I kind of went into this saying, well, that's not really fair. I've been on a community board. I get what it's like, and I, you know, these are people's homes, and I understand why they right. care, and I understand why they get upset. But, you know, the New York Post called them, you know, Nazis or something. I mean, there was obviously whoever reaches the press first, or whoever has a poll with the journalist, is who's going to get the better press. And so there were,
well, is that true?
Restaurateurs. Oh yeah.
Is that true, or is it just you know, who makes the most noise?
Well, yeah. Who makes the most noise? But you know that when you're talking about, you know, hip, wealthy, young, socialite type people who are trying to open a restaurant, and when somebody doesn't give them what they want, that's their microphone happens
right.
to be, you know, the New York Post.
Well, you folks out there, you should Google Jasmine Moy and you should read some of her articles. If you're interested in the hospitality business in New York City, if you're interested in the restaurant business in New York City, Jasmine has some very thoughtful insights. They are not foodie pieces of writing at all, which made me happy because I think Jerry Seinfeld or someone that said the problem with comedy is that there are too many comedy clubs and anybody can just go out and tell a joke mm-hmm. now. I find that with a lot of food writing that I see, it just doesn't intrigue me. But for anybody who takes a position in food writing, I find that to be courageous. I find that to be fearless. And you know, that's a word that's coming up again and again. Mm-hmm. How does somebody else out there who may say, you know, I want to write, I like this space, I don't want to be one of the bazillion mm-hmm. foodie food writers mm-hmm. out there, how does that person get started in selling a piece and in getting going in a career like this?
Yeah, like I said, I took this class at NYU. It changed everything for me, just as far as spelling out the process.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have the process, it's really, you know, the pitching, the finding the person to pitch, the pitch itself, that is the same for everybody. So once you master those two steps, you can really own it. So I think after you've practiced that and owned that, the most important thing you can be doing is always having your eyes open and being right. aware of what's happening so that you can see trends maybe before everybody else sees them. Always be talking to people because you never know who's going to have an interesting story. You never know who's going to be a great source for you or when you're maybe going to want to interview somebody. So always be meeting people, always have your eyes open. But the most important part is to just constantly be writing. You've got to keep writing
right.
and even if you fail again and again and again, you're going to start selling. And all it takes is a few pieces.
ABW.
Yep. Always be writing.
Always be writing. That's terrific. Jasmine, I really appreciate you coming out here today and being a guest. I'm thrilled to hear that lawyers don't have to just be lawyers.
They can
be community board advocates. They can be writers. They can be diners. And they can be radio show guests. So we greatly appreciate you coming out here to Brooklyn today. We'll see all of you next week on The Business of the Business here at the Heritage Radio Network. Jasmine, a little pizza?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it. Maybe we can write something about our experience.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.